Returning was strange.
The war really shifted my life, you know.
It cut a big chunk out of my life. When I came back, I went into the same sort of thing I'd been doing before. I came down to join Shirley. We'd been married by then.
I didn't nurse for 9 years. I thought, well, I'll go back to Bellevue. I can handle it. And I got my old job back. And I think I lasted 3 days.
And I remember one of my last fistfights that I won, a Canadian guy that I was hitchhiking with in Morocco gave me some crap about, you know, warmonger. So I beat him up to show that this pacifist stuff wasn't going to get by me.
Back to civilian life? No trouble at all.
Relief.
I came back from Vietnam and I was a very changed person. I was a very angry person. I'm still angry.
The first thing I did when I got back to my parents' house in Connecticut was I told my mother I had an important chore to do. And she said, what was that? And I got all my olive drab stuff together and made her drive me immediately to a Goodwill box to drop off everything but my field jacket and my gloves. They were good gloves.
The stuff that was essential about me, I made sure didn't change. I was pretty successful in still being pretty much the same guy in important ways when I came out as when I went in.
I felt very much like a stranger in a strange land. The country had changed. I was away for the change. I remember I got back to Berkeley and, you know, girls weren't wearing bras and people were publicly smoking dope and all these improvements.
And when I got out of the Army, I was sad to see that there were no jobs for artillery fire direction center specialists in the local newspaper. So that didn't do much for my career.
And this woman, Linda, calls back and she said, you're the first combat nurse I have gotten to talk to since I came back from Vietnam. And so we talked for hours and hours and hours, compared notes. And then she said, how's your physical health? I said, well, it's funny that you ask. So I kind of gave her a list of some of the problems I had. And then she said, how are your children? And I said, well, that's really funny that you ask. So I told her. And she said, have you ever heard of Agent Orange? Well, I told Linda, yeah, I heard about Agent Orange. I said, but wasn't it just the guys that sprayed it? She said, Lily, you were drinking the water.
I turned 21, came back, had my nervous breakdown, or my wife left me, and then I had my nervous breakdown. In 6 months, Thorazine and good as new shipped me out into the world. And so I had basically a lighter weight encounter with the war than so many of my friends. And I'm more damaged than many of my friends, and yet I'm so much more normal than others of my friends along the way.
I remember working at my desk one day, and an aeroplane buzzed the plant that I was working at, and I headed for under the desk.
I didn't really want to talk about the military at all, and I basically drank for like 6 months straight and didn't really know how to deal with it. I didn't really have any direction that I could go. But later on, I ran into the hippies and joined their army. And I was really grateful for their ways. So.
But living 5 years outside the country was a wonderful experience. I mean, it really opened my eyes to the idea that this country isn't all there is, and that we don't have all the answers, and that people can live quite well, you know, in other places.
You know, I saw the monks by the side of the road, and it intrigued me, their serenity and their peace and amidst all that occupation. But something touched me, and I started investigating. And I've had three or so different Tai Chi teachers, and now I am one, you know. I'm a daily practitioner 30-plus years.
I would say that in getting to be a pilot and fly some of the world's most powerful aircraft at the age of 18 was a major empowerment. Gave me a sense of personal power that I can't imagine getting in any other way at that age. I think that has affected the rest of my life in various ways. It made me feel that I was capable of doing just about anything I set my mind to.
Yeah, it's hard to come back and realize that being on adrenaline for 18 months and being scared for 18 months warps you and makes you not a happy person. So I guess you come back, as they say, at the end of platoon, hey man, it's all gravy after that.
So a lot of my work now is about helping veterans. I mean, I was a child when my father came back from Korea, and he came home with post-traumatic stress. They didn't know what that was then, but I knew my dad wasn't the same man that left when he came back.
And I realized every time I went out into nature, I would play this little game where I was wondering where I was going to be attacked from and figure out where I was going to go hide or how was I going to defend myself. And I did this for 15 years after I was back from Vietnam. And then finally one day I said, no, this is enough. I can enjoy myself. And, you know, it's like a beautiful Sunday morning here in Northern California. Nobody's going to attack me.
But even today, when I'm out in the woods, I'm a soldier when I'm there because I look at the landscape and I take precautions. I think to myself, well, I better go behind this tree and watch the other tree, just like I was in the service, you know. It's burned into me. I do it automatically. And I don't like it, you know, I don't like it.
Because every time there's a helicopter would fly over the house, I run outside, I'm still doing it. Depends on the helicopter. It's still inside me. It'll never leave me. It's still inside me. I can ignore the chopper sometimes. I can hear it, but I know what direction it's coming from or going to without letting myself run outside. And other times I just have to run outside. I just got to do it. Just got to check to see if I have to go to the hospital and receive the wounded.
One of my last experiences, because as I said, I got pregnant. And when I found out I was pregnant, I called up and it's like, hi, this is Captain, you know, so-and-so, and I'm calling to get the results of my pregnancy test. So this airman on the other end comes back on and he goes, ma'am, it's positive. And I mean, he was almost whispering, like he thought it was some horrible disgrace. And I went, whoopee! I said, it's okay, airman, I'm married. He goes, oh, ma'am, congratulations. So a couple of weeks before I got out, they had IG inspection. The team comes in all of a sudden. Well, they came in on Mother's Day. And by this time, I could barely fit in my uniform. I was only a couple of weeks before getting out. And I can remember I was so pissed. How dare they do this on Mother's Day, you know? And I had to go in with a gas mask hanging off and my PIV helmet, you know? And the officers in my unit took one look at me and they said, you in the back office, we don't want anybody seeing you. That was my last experience in the Air Force.
Well, anyway, I wasn't bound determined not to let the experience distort my view of life. And it really was a transformation because the suffering that, you know, that war inflicts and the effect that it has on human being. You hate to see more generations come after you and have to go through it as we're viewing now.
So when I came back, I tried to play baseball again and it wasn't there anymore. That baseball thing really bothered me right up to this day. But what really bothered me during this time in combat, I killed 3 men. I saw 2 that I killed. It's easy to say, oh, you're protecting the country in your war and stuff, but you killed a human being. And I saw the ones I killed. When I came home, I thought it was time to play catch-up. I was an old man. The war makes an old man out of a young guy. You can believe that. No matter how well you are, I was a good soldier, but it still makes an old man out of you. And now I sent all my kids to school. One of them graduated from Harvard. The other one from Wisconsin with doctorate degrees. But I don't know. That war in mature changed my life. I know what basic training is. It's just conditioning you to be a killer. That's what they did. And you had to be, I guess. I don't know. I don't know, you know, but I didn't like that killing. And everybody says, well, you're just protecting yourself. Yeah, that's true. That's true, but you killed somebody. And if you look at the commandments, thou shalt not kill, you wonder what is right and what is wrong. I'm confused.
When we asked for people who had served in the military during wartime, obviously we weren't looking only for combat veterans. It was about how lives change. And so there's another kind of veteran, and we thought, well, is that quite relevant? And we decided, yes.
My husband and I met in 1965, and we got married in September of 67. And we knew at the time that he was probably going to go to Vietnam. It was a pretty strong possibility. But he wanted to get married before we went to Vietnam. So we did. We planned a wedding and we got married. And I got pregnant immediately, which was totally an accident because I had been told by a gynecologist that I couldn't get pregnant, that I needed to have major surgery before I could get pregnant. As it turned out, I got pregnant immediately. He got drafted. And so when he got drafted, he went to see a recruiter. And the recruiter said, if you enlist for an extra year, we'll guarantee you an administrative job. He never got the administrative job. He got a little piece of paper that said, we guarantee you an administrative job. That was in his wallet that came back from Vietnam after he was killed. And he carried that little piece of paper around like it meant something. And every time he'd get orders, he'd pull out that paper and say, well, what about this guarantee that I'm going to be in administration? And they would just laugh at him. So that's how he got in the Army. Pretty much, I felt like I really couldn't do anything about it. Like it was just like this snowball that just kept getting bigger and bigger, and I couldn't really change it. You know, he was going to war, and, you know, it was inevitable, and the war was getting bigger and bigger, and I really felt powerless and helpless, like I can't affect any change. My husband, I think, when he went to Vietnam, he felt that it was his duty to fight communism. His father had been in World War II, and he was a patriot, you know. He was going to do his duty. He was going to go to war if there was a war going on. And, I mean, he didn't really want to go, but if it was his duty, he was going to go. So he went over there believing that he was fighting communism. And in one of his last letters that I got, he was beginning to find out the truth of what was really going on and that the war was being fought for economic reasons. I can't remember the exact line, but it was kind of sickening to him. He said something about it's rather sickening to see that human lives are being used this way. And within a month, his life was used the same way. Anyway, he was only there 2 months before he was killed in action in Saigon during the Minh Tet Offensive. And by then I was 7 months pregnant. How did I get the news? Well, intuitively, I knew he had died. I got a forewarning. I was reading the paper one Sunday, and I saw an article about a battle in Vietnam, and it was way in the back pages of the St. Louis paper. I was living in Southern Illinois at the time. And the article was directly about my husband's unit. It was his company, his platoon, his battalion. All the numbers were there. And I thought, my God, this is him. And at the end of the article, it said, we were lucky. We had only 4 killed and, you know, so many wounded in action. And I knew at that moment that my husband was dead. And I just went into this episode of crying, and my mother came out and said, what's wrong? And I said, he's dead, Mom. And she said, what's the matter with you? And I said, I just know he's dead. And then 5 days later, those 5 days I was going through hell, I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat. 5 days later, the Green Army sedan pulled up in front of my parents' home, and I went to the window and I told my mom, they're now coming to tell me that he's dead. And that was the case. They sat in the car for a long time. 2 men got out and straightened their uniforms, put their hat on, and walked to my door. And, you know, when I opened the door and they saw my pregnant abdomen, I'm sure that must have knocked them for a loop. They wanted to know. They were looking for Pauline Query. And I said, I'm Pauline Query. That's me. And they just were silent for a long time. And then finally they started reading this telegram that they had. They actually literally read it to me. Your husband has been mortally wounded. And my mind just started racing around, mortally wounded. Does that mean dead? Does that mean alive? If he's wounded, maybe he's still alive. And I was really very shy at the time. And I just tried to figure out in my head what that meant, mortally wounded. And they came in, and then they just went through everything with me. The cemetery, the body will come back, the medals. I only retained bits and pieces of that. I was in shock. And then they left. And then it was 2 weeks after that when his body came back, and when his body came back, it said non-viewable. And what that meant was that it was hermetically sealed. We could not open it. People wouldn't let me cry. They kept saying, you have to be strong because you're pregnant. You have to eat, you have to sleep, you have to take care of yourself because you're carrying his child. So my life then became about his child. Yeah. My daughter, it was amazing. She looked like a little version of my husband. I just was shocked when I looked at her. I thought, my God, I have given birth to him. She looked exactly like him. I remember thinking, I have to look at her to see what's wrong with her, because I have to look and see where she's damaged. Does she have 10 fingers? Does she have 10 toes? Is her head okay? Because I just felt that she was going to be so damaged by the trauma that I went through. Well, as it turned out, she was traumatized, but it wasn't trauma that I could see. Right now, she's 35 years old, and she's experiencing severe panic attacks and anxiety. And I'm not surprised. Our country is at war. And she told me once that every day when she wakes up, the first thing that enters her mind is, who's going to die today? Who do I love is going to die today? I was living with my parents at the time in a very small town in southern Illinois. I remember looking back that I was kind of numb, and I look at pictures of myself and I just see a dead woman walking around with a baby in her arms. I could never hold a job. I could never have a healthy relationship with a man, because I had all this turmoil inside of me. And in 1990, when I lost a job and ended a relationship, both of which were very significant, I fell into a deep depression and I was suicidal. And when the pain gets that deep, you either kill yourself or you heal. And I probably would have killed myself if I had not had a daughter. And, you know, my thoughts were, well, maybe this isn't his body. And as it turned out, that's what I did. My mind was so overwhelmed and I was so distraught that I hung onto this thread of maybe this wasn't him. And I see now in retrospect that that's what I had to do in order to survive. So I denied his death. Because I didn't see him dead, I denied it. And that denial, sadly to say, continued for 25 years until my daughter came to my door one day and said, I'm getting married. So we started planning her wedding, and I started having flashbacks to my own wedding and what happened after I got married. And I realized that I was letting go of the only piece of him that I had left, which was our daughter. And that's when I started writing and talking about being a Vietnam widow. And 7 years later, my book was finished, and I had cried all the tears that I couldn't cry back then. Because when his personal effects came back from Vietnam, I put it all in a box, I taped the box shut, and I stuck that box in the back of my closet. And every time I moved, I'd come across this box, Vietnam, and I'd get this foreboding feeling, and I'd say, you know, get this box in the back of the next closet quickly. Don't hang out with this box too long, because literally it feels like that grief is going to kill you. If you let yourself go into it, it feels like it could kill you. But the miraculous truth is that it will give you new life if you're willing to go to the grief. It will give you new life. I opened the box. I had given my daughter that box of things. I said, I need that box back. So she brought it back, and I opened the box, and I started going through the contents of it, and I had to do it very gradually because it was very scary for me. I could only do so much at a time, and then I would have to put it away. I was in Santa Rosa living in a small one-bedroom apartment, and the box was sitting in the middle of my living room, basically. My therapist was key because she's the first person in all these years that I found who would let me cry. I used to see her once a week for an hour, and basically I would just go sit in her office and cry, and she would allow me to cry. So I cried for 2 or 3 years, and then I started talking about why I was crying. Well, in the box were letters, personal effects, his wallet with pictures in his wallet, socks, underwear. There was a photo album that he had kept his photos in that I had sent him. And so there was a photo album of pictures of me pregnant at my mother's house. There was some pictures that he was going to send me that he had never sent me yet. So I was happy to see, you know, pictures of him in Vietnam. There were some audio tapes. At the time, we would send audio tapes back and forth. And his wedding ring was in there. And, you know, when I found his wedding ring, it was like the denial could not last any longer, because I knew that he must have been dead, or his wedding ring wouldn't have come back. There was a couple, actually more than a couple letters that came back that they weren't in the box. They came back in the mail. They had been addressed to him, and there was a big red stamp on them that said, verified deceased, return to sender. Verified deceased. So in the box, yeah, it was all of his personal things in Vietnam, you know, the evidence that he was there. His wallet was wet. When he died, he was in water, and everything in his wallet was wet and moldy. So the whole box had that moldy smell to it, which I associate with Vietnam. You know, the combat vets, they associate gunpowder and blood, the smell of gunpowder and blood together with Vietnam. But I associate this moldy box of letters that had been sealed up for 25 years. So the opening of that box was really the beginning of my healing. And so now all those things that were in the box are in a different box, and I've given them to my daughter and said, I've written my book, I've told my story, you want this stuff? So she has it now.
We thought we were invincible. You know, we were 18 years old, 19. We knew we weren't going to get it. The guys in the next plane might. But I can remember that feeling to this day, flying into battle with this mass of bombers with all these guns, and feeling the power of that situation, and feeling that no fighter was going to get to us. And somehow we felt invulnerable to, right up till the anti-aircraft shell hit a plane and it blew up, the guys in that plane thought they were invincible. I don't know why, but it's an attitude that we all carried, and I guess it was absolutely necessary in order to do the job we had. We had to be convinced of our indestructibility.
I think militaries, in principle, are a good thing. You need to have some people with guns to defend you, because there's a lot of people, bad people with guns in the world that will take over and rape people and everything, you know, just screw you up if you don't have some defense. But it appears to me that most of the time when militaries are used, it's not in defense of anything that should be defended. It's more like, I see countries as criminal gangs, basically.
Pacifists have said, you know, since then, yeah, but you killed people. And I said, yeah, yeah, that's what people do when they're attacked. They tend to kill the attackers. And I don't make any apologies for that. It's too bad the world has to be like that, but it is.
Yeah, there really has to be a better way of doing it. And I think there comes a time, well, I guess, when you have to use force. But it's only because we made too many mistakes, and I'm not sure we're not there right now.
I still feel killing is killing. And when you take somebody's life, I knew that Hitler was a terrible person, no question about that. But you know, when I look at it, who made Hitler? Who made this person called Hitler? where did he get all the money from that big war machine? Who gave him the money?
We, the soldiers who have returned from battles stained with blood, we who have seen our relatives and friends killed before our eyes, we who have come from a land where parents bury their children, we who have fought against you, we say to you today in a loud and clear voice, enough of blood and tears. Enough.
Yeah, I had an experience when they had the replica of the Vietnam Memorial at our junior college, and I went the day before because I wanted to check out the situation. And right as I pulled up my van, there was another van that pulled up. The other van was painted camouflage and had bumper stickers on it like, kill them all, let God sort out the rest. And there was this fella in there that was a double amputee with the army fatigues on, and he was there to check out the situation. And so was I. I was in my hippie van, and I had my headband on and my long braids. We both looked at each other when we got there, and we understood. You know, we understood each other, why we're there.
You were listening to War Veterans. The voices you heard were Bill O'Hara, Clifton Amsbury, Dixon Ragg, James Spencer, Gene Watson, Judith Coates, Kevin Powers, Thomas, Lino Valentini, Lily Jean Adams, Tim Gregory, Sharon Kufelt, Tom Harriman, and Pauline Laurent. Literary quotes from Edmund Gossett, Joseph Demestre, Mussolini, William Burroughs, Thomas Hardy, von Clausewitz, Lloyd George, Mao Zedong, Machiavelli, Clemenceau, Ruth Benedict, and Yitzhak Rabin.
Several have written books or have websites. James Spencer's documentary novel, The Pilots, is published by Putnam and available everywhere. And Pauline Laurent has written of her experience as a war widow in Grief Denied, A Vietnam Widow's Story. Information on that is available at www.griefdenied.com.
And we'd like to hear your voice. Send us your stories to info@hitching.org. That's our new web address where you can hear past shows and samples of our CDs. That's www.hitching.org.
Hitchhiking Off the Map is produced by The Independent Eye, with funding from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Hitchhikers Guild.
Next month, At Risk, a 90-year-old woman walks across the U.S. A wilderness hiker survives disaster. And have you ever had that urge to sneak something through airport security? Tune in. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller. Peace and joy.
You know, it's like when you're a veteran, there's a certain process that happens when you talk to people. A question comes up, and there's a certain line of questioning that happens. And it's like they'll ask you what branch of the service you're in. They'll ask you where you're stationed, and they'll ask you, were you overseas? And then they'll ask you, were you in the war? And then they'll ask you if you killed somebody. Then they'll ask you, did somebody try to kill you? And they'll want to know how that felt. And I think people ask this question of veterans, no matter which war they were in, because deep down inside, they really know that life is precious.